This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
Hello, everyone. It has been a little bit, a couple months, 6 months. We are back for episode 41, and I'm excited for this episode because we're getting together with some old faces. I'm sitting next to Dr. Abrams.
Hello, everyone. Good to be back.
I have Kaushik across the table from me.
What's up, everyone? Kevin, unfortunately, has not been able to get rid of me over the past few months, so it's good to be back.
And then two new faces that we're excited to introduce. We'll let Andrew say hey first.
Hey, everyone. This is Andrew Mohammed. I'm a third-year medical student at Rush. Really excited to be on Alert and Oriented.
And next to him, we have Caroline.
Hey, everyone. I'm Caroline Wang. I'm a M1 at Rush. I just finished my first block, and I'm really excited to be here.
We're really excited to share a case with them in a little bit, but we have some catching up to do. Some news. Carolyn's our earliest learner that we've had on the podcast, so that's going to be fun. I think we've always had M3 or greater.
I think so.
This will be fun to put her in the hot seat for some clinical reasoning. Kaushik, how's intern year going?
So far, so good, man. I am also 3 months into my intern year at Rush right now. So far, so good. I want to give a quick shout out to my old partner in crime on the podcast, Nathan, who is killing the game right now out in Boston. So shout out, Nathan. But it's been awesome. You know, I was able to meet Dr. Abrams through Kevin, and he interviewed me during my Rush residency interview, which is awesome. So it's nice to get the game back together. Talk some shop.
And Dr. Abrams, what's new with you?
There's not too much new with me. A lot of personal stuff. So my son got married last month, and my daughter's having our first grandchild next month. So those are personal nice things. Otherwise, everything is very much the same for me. Now, I want to go to you, Kevin, because I think your life is probably potentially changing the most. So why don't you fill us in?
Some light stuff has been happening for sure. I just finished my last fellowship interview today, going into pulmonary and critical care. So that's exciting to have behind me, and the match is less of a wait than it was for residency. So I will be somewhere in Chicago. I kept my list short and want to stay home. For the reason that I'm having my second child.
Oh, wow.
Due in December.
A big month.
Sneaking up here. Yeah. Similar to last match day, my wife was giving birth a week after match day, and she's due a week after match day this awesome. Time around, too. This is my last match, so I think definitely the last kid. But we're having a baby girl, and then my son Grady's 2.5, and yeah, life has been crazy, but enjoying every minute.
It's awesome.
What PGY year are you now?
I'm going to be PGY 40 next year. This is my 40. PGY 39 year here.
Jeez.
I'm going to get it right finally.
What, you got any ideas on fellowship?
Not too good. Looking for something long, maybe EP.
Yeah, there we go. You can see the crowd.
I'm going to apply to neurosurgery again for this.
All right, let's get started and dive into the case. I think Kaushik will start us off here.
Yeah, all right, team, let's kick it off. So as we know, we usually start as broad as can possibly be, much to the delight of our discussants. So let's go ahead and start with the patient you have in front of you, who is a 75-year-old male who presents with jaundice. And that's all the information you have right now. So I think what is often helpful, you have a big kind of broad chief complaint. How do you start to make it manageable? How do you start to think about something like this?
Caroline, do you want to start?
Sure. So the block I just finished was actually infectious disease. So when I hear jaundice, I'm immediately thinking about like, oh, could it be HHV-4 or could it be HHV-5? I know that's the category of infectious disease, but there could be other differentials as well. Maybe like chronic liver disease, or it could be something else like genetic that we have yet to learn, but we'll learn soon.
Yeah, that's a great start, Caroline. I remember finishing that block and just being overwhelmed by how much infections there were out there. It was a little terrifying. It still is to me.
You gotta stay sharp.
For me, when I think about this, well, there's two things I look at. I look at the age. This guy is 75, so you gotta think about problems that might happen later in life. And then jaundice, the way I've started to think through this is into three categories. I go pre-hepatic, I go intrinsic, and I go post-hepatic jaundice. This is something that kind of came up in my surgery rotation. I haven't done internal medicine, but I've done surgery, and there is a good amount of medicine in that. And like when I think about pre-hepatic, that's like the hemolysis type stuff, and possibly hematomas, I remember we talked about that. When I think about intrinsic, that's directly things involving the liver, so the hepatitis, like infectious type stuff that Caroline was saying, could even be like cancers of the liver, could be alcohol-related cirrhosis, etc. And then I think I'm in the post-hepatic world is things like gallstones, strictures, et cetera. And those are like often leading to an obstructive cause. So I try to bucket into those three categories at first.
I think you're both expressing the ways that you start to categorize and form buckets for a really broad chief complaint. So Caroline, you mentioned an infectious bucket. You mentioned a genetic disease bucket. And then Andrew, you mentioned thinking about it more anatomically, like pre-hepatic, intrinsic, post-hepatic, and then buckets within that. Carolyn, you also mentioned thinking about the time course, right? Because you mentioned chronicity, whether we're talking about an acute, subacute, or chronic process, totally shifts how we think about this. I think that was awesome.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Abrams has always said this, when you're faced with a patient with a problem, it's what can you use that is most unusual to guide your next steps? I personally love jaundice because for the almost, I really have a hard time thinking of a non-hepatic reason for jaundice. I love Andrew's approach pre, intra, and post. I really think of it as the liver, this organ that has tubes coming in and tubes coming out. So is it a problem with the tubes coming in? Is it a problem with the liver itself, or is something backing up the tubes coming out that you're then having this increased bilirubin for? So I love this initial approach. I think using a system like this, you're gonna at least think about most things that could be causing this, and then it certainly will guide your next steps.
The only other thing I'd say is always to think about the lookalikes.
Yeah.
I can say this person has jaundice, and I at least have to ask the question, are there things that look like jaundice that are jaundice? Mm-hmm. And that's it's just something to always keep in the back of your mind. People are going to come to you and say, oh, I'm seeing this person who has whatever. You have to say, okay, that's great. I'm going to take people at face value, but are there other things you should think about?
I think about this a lot, this concept. In general medicine, pulmonology, critical care, pneumonia is probably the most common infection we see, especially in the ICU. Pneumonia and pneumonia mimics are always something. So like, if everything's pointing at pneumonia, you still got to think about the mimics because it helps keep you grounded and that you're not anchoring. I think that's what Dr. is getting at. Well, let's go to Alpha 2. The patient feels unwell for about a month. He began to experience some abdominal discomfort and he had relief with bowel. He was fatigued, had a poor appetite. On the day prior to coming in, his wife noticed his skin started to turn yellow. So I think here we're getting a lot of information about the chronicity. So how does this detail guide help change your differential and thought process?
I can start. When I read that on the day prior to his presentation, his wife noticed that his skin was yellow, I think, okay, well, definitely confirmed jaundice, or at least a jaundice mimic, for the past 24 hours. It's interesting that there's been fatigue and a poor appetite for the past week, and the abdominal discomfort has been for a month. That makes me point more towards something chronic and highlights my differentials, like maybe yellow fever or HHV-4/5.
Yeah, I'm very impressed. Even to just pick out those details, Caroline, is an M1.
Thank you so much.
I think I would read this and just say, like, this guy's tired, and what's jaundice? That's the yellow? That's probably what I would have been thinking as an M1. So, that's a helpful start. I think, yeah, the time course is super important here. I'd be really curious to know if the yellow, the jaundice, was just 24 hours, or if it was present for much longer, because you're spending so much time with someone, like a wife, then it's hard to tell, like, did this start one day or did this slowly progress over time? That's something I think time is not always the time you're told. I've realized that in some clinical encounters. And I think that same thing can go for the other two points here about a month earlier began to have some discomfort. Like, what's this guy's baseline level of, you know, physical experiences and physical symptoms? Is his discomfort something that's normally present in his life and is this worsened? Or is this like a true, like, he went from no discomfort to now discomfort? But when I think about fatigue, I think about discomfort, I think a guy's 75 years old, I start to be worried about malignancy. They teach us a lot about what are your can't miss diagnoses. Sometimes it's a joke that you throw cancer on every differential, but it really is seeming that way. You kind of have to, because yeah. It very much creeps its way into a lot of clinical scenarios. So I would want to off the bat think, okay, what should we do to make sure this is not a malignancy, and ask the appropriate follow-up questions to that. And that, I mean, there's just so many follow-up questions I have to this ALQOT. Even though we have more details here, it's something that maybe points me into a direction of questions.
Cool. Well, what would a couple of those questions be?
I want to know, has this person traveled? Are they eating anything different? Are they eating a bunch of carrots and suddenly their skin started to change color? Just thinking about jaundice lookalikes. I want to know their bowel movements. What do they look like? Is there blood in the stool? What's the consistency of them? How frequent are they? I want to know, is this person losing weight? And, you know, what specifically the poor appetite looks like to him. Caroline, are there any other questions that come to mind for you that you'd want to ask?
I think you hit on a lot of them, but I really resonate with the travel and the bowel movements, descriptions of that. And maybe I thought it was really interesting how you pointed out his baseline discomfort and how that might compare relative to what he's experiencing now.
Great, and just filled with so many pearls. I'm so impressed, both from an early M3 and an M1. Not to knock you, but like we talked about before this, early learners, M1, M2, rarely practice clinical reasoning. So to hear Caroline articulate her thought process is very impressive. What Andrew's doing a really great job of, without saying it, is he's trying to formulate the base rate. By that, he's layering in the patient's age so that older people experience unique sets of problems that aren't exclusive to them, but they're more likely. So that's changing how you're thinking about this. You're layering on the chronicity. So things that are happening slowly, more indolent, make you think about particular things. You mentioned malignancy. And then you have targeted questions. And through your questions, I have a great sense of where your thought process is at and what you're thinking just from your questions and how they would kind of change things. So very impressive. Anything to add, guys?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, again, you guys have been great so far. Maybe one comment, then a thought, because I do think about jaundice, and when you see lots of people that come in with this complaint, it is almost always that some other person notices that they're jaundiced. The person almost never notices it themselves. Part of it may be what you said, Andrew, and that is, we'll get to tempo in a second. Like you say, they don't notice it, and then somebody else always says, oh my God, you look yellow. And I think we're early in the case, but it's something to always keep in mind. Part of our training, we developed what we would call illness scripts. So we start saying, oh, this disease, and remember, anytime I say this is the way it presents, that just means it could present totally different. But there's sort of a standard story, because storytelling is important here, as to how that disease develops. And we did already talk about tempo, and I think is so important. And the tempo of jaundice, kind of a funny one.
Yeah.
Right? Because the tempo tends to be slow, except for very certain conditions, one of which you mentioned. If somebody hemolyzes all their blood over the space of 2 hours, they'll get jaundice relatively quickly.
Right.
But many of the illnesses, a very specific tempo.
And I love tempo. And the reason being is it kind of tells you how quickly you need to act. This really hasn't failed me yet, but things that happen acutely often need to be managed acutely. And things that are more chronic, indolent, which is kind of the picture I'm getting painted here, you have more time to think about it. You can actually work more towards diagnosis versus immediate treatment.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's interesting that I've learned through my psychiatry rotation is when we gather collateral, where you call family members, case managers, social workers, as long as the patient's okay with this, to ask them about the patient. And it's been a really interesting exercise for me to figure out what is the true clinical truth here. This is just another layer to the discussion Dr. Abrams continued about the tempo of things. It's been really interesting to call a family member and hear something completely different than you hear from the patient themselves. And, you know, I'll be curious to see if that plays out. I mean, you're all in internal medicine, so I'll ask you that. Is that a component of your care?
Oh, yeah. I think an example that just came to mind is you as a medical student in medicine have an hour-long discussion with the patient in the morning, then we go in together during runs, and they tell us a completely different story.
Yeah.
Then the reflection is, did you just make all that up?
And then you as a vet, have to tell your attending, I swear I talked to the patient this morning, and I promise I did this HMP.
Yeah, I mean, stories change from patients, and then families are almost always adding to the story.
It's amazing. So, and you just mentioned a lot of the follow-up questions that you were going to have and some of the information that you're going to try and dive through. This patient's past medical history has a history of hypertension, paroxysmal AFib, and CKD stage 2. No recent travel history, no sick contacts. He does not smoke. He drinks alcohol socially, no more than 2 to 3 drinks per week. He denies any illicit substances, new medications, or supplements, and he denied any rash or joint pain. His medications include metoprolol, apixaban, and omeprazole. He has no known allergies. So with some of this follow-up information now, we have a little bit more past medical history, have a little bit more review systems, we have some of his medications. How does this start to move things up and down that differential that you're already starting to build?
So what I'm seeing in this aliquot is that he has some past medical history and he's also on some medication for his AFib. The no recent travel really does knock down a lot of the HH3-4-5 yellow fever differentials that I was thinking about. And now this is kind of pointing me more in the direction of something chronic.
Yeah, it's a good start, Caroline. One thing I will say, we never found out where this person lives. So they could live in an area that has endemic something going on, right? Some mosquitoes that are giving... But yeah, I think for the purposes of where we are right now, this is most likely in the U.S. So I agree. Those things are lower on the differential. In this past medical history, to my knowledge, I don't think any of these conditions, hypertension, AFib, CKD, directly caused jaundice. So, like, first thing I'm thinking, it's probably not an exacerbation of a current medical problem. You know, not great to have those things, but not maybe causing the exact clinical scenario we see right now. The big thing that I didn't mention earlier that is definitely huge here is like substances this patient ingests. The fact that he only drinks socially, no more than 2 to 3 drinks weekly, probably lowers like cirrhosis on my differential. That's going to be pretty low if that is truthful, that, you know, that's the amount he drank. The lack of smoking is really big here. Like, I've learned that smoking is like number one or two in terms of risk factors for so many types of malignancy. I think about what malignancies can cause jaundice, like pancreatic cancer in the head of the pancreas, causing an obstructive situation. Also, I don't know how often this presents in pancreatic cancer, but with no rash, I think about that. I'm forgetting the name of the sign. I think it's Trousseau's sign, where you have this red rash throughout your body, and that can be a sign of a pancreatic malignancy. Not that I'm completely ruling out malignancy, but it maybe is lower on my differential, given what's here.
Yeah.
I mean, I have more thoughts. Maybe I'll pause there for a second.
Great. I think there's some risk factors you were looking for that aren't here. So for that reason, it's lowering certain things. You highlighted his medical problems. These are things we commonly see in a lot of folks we take care of. Exposure history being things I like to think about when I meet patients are, where are they born? Where have they been living? And what did they do for work? So I think you can get a good sense of like environmental and occupational exposures as they kind of pertain to whatever complaint they have. And then the other is medications. We'll soon talk about liver injury, and medications is a huge bucket of that. And these are meds I see in almost everyone every day. There's tools you can use to look at medicines as they're associated with liver injury, but these don't immediately ring a bell.
I just want to drive home one of the points that Kevin made, that medical history, past medical conditions, medications they take are crucial. Social history, getting a good social history from a patient, what their background is, substance use, alcohol, smoking, other recreational drugs, any sort of substance use that a patient might have a history of is huge. It's something that you always need to keep in mind because it can totally influence the way you're thinking about a problem in front of you. It's not always the most intuitive thing to think about when you're really focused on a chief complaint, their review systems, and their past medical history. I've found it to be so helpful over the past 3 months and even longer than that, and, you know, is a key part of this puzzle too.
Just to continue with that, and it goes back to what you were talking about. I will tell you this, and that is, this person is from this area, so you should know that. But it does go back to what you just heard, and that is the social parts of it. The social history, the family history, and certainly the drugs, because in my mind, it's the drug until proven otherwise. Yes. I mean, that's the first thing I always say, okay, let me look at the list. And then you look at the drugs that you sort of don't know, and then I'm pulling out my phone and saying, well, does it cause this side effect or not? Because so many drugs, certainly now with, you know, this sort of explosion of you know, biologics, things like that, there's all these side effects then, you know, certainly when I was a medical student, they were like 10 drugs.
And not just drugs, but supplements, especially in liver injury. Huge missed, commonly missed thing immediately. Like, you ask about the medicines or you review the medicines and nothing looks like a culprit med, but then you're missing that they're taking 20 supplements from some website.
And I'll add briefly, as I'm looking at this, this is another thing I've learned in psychiatry, to really hone in on social history, like the 2 to 3 drinks weekly, what does a drink look like to this patient? Are the 2 to 3 drinks like 2 to 3 bottles of wine? Because that's come up even in this 1 month rotation on psychiatry I've had, where people have had way more to drink than I would consider a drink.
Yeah. Let's get some physical information. We have our physical exam. Temperature is afebrile at 98. The respiratory rate's 12. His pulse is 80. His blood pressure is a bit hypertensive, 148 over 70. His sclera are icteric. His pulmonary exam is normal. His cardiac exam is also normal. The abdominal exam, he's soft, non-distended. He has mild right upper quadrant tenderness to deep palpation. No organomegaly was appreciated. He's jaundiced appearing, no telangiectasia. His neuro exam, he's alert and oriented. His strength is 5 out of 5. He has no asterixis. So this was a focus exam.
Nice.
There's some pertinent positives, and I think more importantly, pertinent negatives. What do you guys think?
Looking at this right away, some pertinent positives. The skin exam with the jaundice.
Which I still have trouble with.
Really points me to not as much of hepatic chronic issue. I think the lack of organomegaly is also a really great pointer. It helps further knock down those differentials about EBV and stuff like that. Love the alert and oriented thrown in. And yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
Nice. Again, even to come up with words like that as an M1 in your first block, it's impressive. I'm looking at this and there's nothing glaring at me that this is urgent or emergent necessarily. Hemodynamically, they're hypertensive, but if they have baseline hypertension, CKD, I'm not terribly concerned about the hypertension. Their heart is, you know, seemingly great based on the physical exam. Not great, but it's fine. You know, if the lungs are clear, then we can rule out something that involves, at least based on auscultation, like the lungs. But we're seeing the yellowing of the eyes. The skin is jaundiced, and the right upper quadrant tenderness, the right upper quadrant has a lot going on there. That's kind of where I'm anchoring right now. Up there, we have the liver, the gallbladder, the biliary tree, possibly head of the pancreas, part of the colon up there, or small intestine. I'm kind of just thinking in that area, there's so much going on there that could lead to jaundice that I'd want to examine that a lot. That's probably where I would choose to dive in. And I agree with Caroline that the lack of like sputtering angiomas, you know, the non-distension lack of ascites, like, brings like cirrhosis type picture lower on my differential.
Awesome. I want to quickly touch on one point that you both made that I think is so great when you mentioned just their vital signs and stability, because I think that with any patient you're evaluating, the first thing you're thinking about is this patient sick or not sick? And I think that's oftentimes a question that can frame how you view an entire patient. When they're coming up to the floor and you need to try and triage, how worried am I about this patient and how on edge do I need to be? Because based on the differential that you both are starting to build, it sounds like we're starting to focus on that right upper quadrant. There's a lot going on there, one organ of which is the liver. And if that is or isn't the culprit here, I will say that patients with liver issues and liver disease can be very, very sick. And they can get very, very sick very, very quickly. So I think that was a great point in terms of looking at the vitals quickly, having a focused physical exam, and starting to triage in your mind, okay, they look like they're hemodynamically stable, nothing crazy is jumping out at me on exam. I think I have some time here to figure out what's going on.
So proud of Patrick.
I learned it all from Kevin. That's kind of the palm crit. That's so tough.
Now, the biggest thing I hope to teach learners that are with me is feeling confident in recognizing sick and not sick. I think the biggest transition from medical school to residency is that point right there. It can be life or death. You're often the first physician seeing a patient. If you don't appropriately recognize sick, that person's trajectory is down spiraling with potentially nothing in place. So that skill is crucial. And then Carolyn, so impressive on a physical exam. Just, you didn't even say it, but you're basically saying this patient doesn't have stigmata cirrhosis. And that's a huge pertinent negative here because it provides more information about the tempo and the pathology here, I think, which we'll get into soon.
I'm going to ask you guys a question because I think we're going to go on to lab studies in a minute, but I think it's always useful to reassess what you think now. Now going through the history and physical, or the history and physical that's been presented, which I hope is complete in the context of this case, and think about change the way you've thought based upon what you've heard. Remember, the reality is that tests help move you to a diagnosis. One of the things we often see is that people come with tests already. I'm not necessarily sure that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
Often it's a bad thing. It's certainly bad for the patient, but it also changes the way we think that the pre-test time is the right time to stop and say, okay, what do I think now? Then you can decide how the test results for either shift you towards or away from what you're thinking.
Yeah, that has been one of my biggest learning points this year as well, that I've learned from so many great residents and faculty, is that you should only order a lab or a study if you know what you're going to do with the result. I think that I have heard so many times now, and it's so true, where the question is, how is this going to change your management? How is this going to change how you view the patient in front of you? And so just being really critical about that. You know, so to Dr. Abrams' point, are you reassessing it all and thinking about next steps and workup? Anything that you want to look at in particular or any testing that you want to do?
Get one test each.
I don't know too much about testing just yet, but this is kind of in line with the physical exam. I think something I'd really want to add on is looking for edema and checking if it's bilateral and using that to guide me to my next steps.
I would want to do a right upper quadrant ultrasound.
Great. What would you wear, Kashi?
I think that I would go nice and easy and get a CMP. Let's check some liver labs and go from there.
Between liver or ultrasound?
Liver labs and ultrasound.
Yeah, I agree with you, Andrew. I would want the ultrasound, but that's going to give me...
I think that's more important.
Information.
Sure. I think, you know, abnormal liver tests, normal liver tests, we're still getting the right upper quadrant.
Correct.
Well, it goes back to your original point, thinking about this anatomically, because that really helps answer that anatomic issue. The pre-hepatic stuff is unusual, but the other two are the common buckets. Hopefully that will help you distinguish between those two buckets.
All right, we're going to talk about some lab work. And I'm going to share some reference. I'll say normal or abnormal just to help Carolyn out here too. So the hemoglobin was 15.8, which is normal. The white blood cell count was 5.9, which is normal. The platelets were 160, which is in the normal range also. On the basic chemistry, the creatinine was 1.42, which I presume is the baseline. The electrolytes were all normal. On the liver panel, the alkaline phosphatase was 195, which is mildly elevated. The ALT was 888. The AST was 821, which are markedly elevated. The total bilirubin is 17, which is markedly elevated. The INR was 1.2, which is just mildly abnormal. And the albumin was 3.7, which is roughly normal. The right upper quadrant ultrasound was limited due to some bowel gas. But within the limitations of this, they noted some cholelithiasis, so gallstones in the... There was no sonographic evidence of cholecystitis.
I feel pretty good about my call on the liver labs right now. I feel okay about it.
I'm with you.
Okay, I'll let you start if you have any preliminary thoughts.
Yeah, great to see that the white blood cell count, platelet count is normal. That does help, you know, further knock down those differentials that I talked about earlier. A very big pointer is the ALT and the AST level. I can also see the creatinine indicating the CKD type 2. Yeah. And yeah, so I think the gallbladder stones helps give me a little bit more context to the abdominal discomfort he might have been feeling throughout the month. That makes me wonder, is there something I should look for there? I would also want to look into the ALT and AST levels.
Great.
Yeah, that's an amazing start. I'm thinking of a heuristic I have, which I know is not always helpful, but as a med student, it can be, especially on exams. There's this mnemonic called VATS, V-A-T-S, for any time you see ALT, AST upwards close to 1,000, and stands for viral hepatitis, autoimmune hepatitis, toxicity, so drugs, and then S for shock liver, so ischemic liver.
Great.
So when I see those levels, where I'm being pushed towards, because what I've learned is that you're not going to see this level of elevation super frequently unless it's pointing to a couple different things. Another thing that is interesting is the ratio between the two. Say for some reason we didn't believe the 2 to 3 social drinks a week. I learned also that like if the AST is twice as high as the ALT, that's sometimes also a heuristic to show that maybe there's an alcohol-induced problem in the liver. Alcohol-induced problems are very much off my differential, and I'm thinking about that VATS mnemonic at this point.
Yeah, I love that. I haven't heard that one, but one I use, like very similar to the approach I use, and there is a liver test this elevated narrows your differential. There are very few things that can cause this. You've hit on almost all of them. The only one I can think of is a vascular reason, namely Budd-Chiari, like portal vein thrombosis. Another approach I think that we should explore is the pattern of the liver injury too. So how does the alkaline phosphatase layer into your thinking?
Do you have any thoughts?
No, not
yet. Honestly, this is something I need practice with because I have to relearn this every time I look at these labs, which part of the right upper quadrant are these exact markers coming from. Good. They signify different things. I feel like for most of medical school, it just all meant one thing to me. So actually, to preserve the integrity of the markers, I would love for one of you to walk us through that, actually.
Yeah, so I think, I'm just getting a lot of eyeballs out of here right now, which I love, because I think what Kevin is sort of getting at here is that when I look at liver labs, I usually start with the alkaphos, the ALT, and the AST to sort of frame my thinking. The first question is, we have an elevated alkaphos, an elevated AST, and an elevated ALT. Are any of those more markedly elevated than the others? Does one just jump out at you as this is way bigger of a spike than the rest?
Yeah, ALT, AST, definitely the highest.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I think that's the first question. AST, ALT, our actual transaminase levels are higher than our alkaphos significantly. So then we can start to think about what's referred to commonly as the R factor or the R ratio. And generally that's gonna tell us what is the ratio between our transaminase elevation and our alkaphos elevation, right? Because then it will tell us, are our liver labs more so in a hepatocellular pattern of damage or a cholestatic pattern of damage, right? And what that's basically telling us is whatever's going on in our liver right now, is it attacking our liver cells directly and causing them to lyse and take a whole bunch of damage? Or is there a problem with our bile flow, our bile ducts, and that's causing our alkaphos to spike and maybe causing some hepatocyte damage on the side, right? So what you guys mentioned was a very high AST and ALT. Just to let you guys know, in this case, the R factor would be like 13 to 14, which is very high. And that tells us hepatocellular damage. So that clues us into, and I think a lot of what Andrew mentioned is differential, where maybe you mentioned hepatitis, autoimmune, toxins, and shock liver. Things that would directly attack the liver cells, cause them to take a lot of damage and take a huge spike, right? Because also, like you mentioned with alcoholic cirrhosis, great point on the ratio that you would see in the AST and ALT. You also generally wouldn't expect those numbers to be that high. You know, they might be in the low hundreds or so, and so that would be very surprising. So I think I look at those, and then I look at the INR and the albumin. I think those also clue me into a couple key things. Our liver's job is to produce things and to filter things. So the INR is kind of telling us, is the liver still having good synthetic function? Is it doing its job to produce the things that it needs to? And the albumin can also sort of clue us in as to how long has this process been going on. So that's generally how I start to think about it. What do you guys think?
I completely align with all of that. I think just to build on the synthetic, we're also going to look at the platelets because TP, a liver-directed hormone. And then something we haven't talked about yet, because I think it's kind of taken a backseat, is the bilirubin, right? It's 17. And it's going to be important to differentiate whether it's direct or indirect. I think we have a pretty good idea right now what it will be, because nothing else in the history is suggesting that this is going to be an indirect problem. So kind of appropriately has taken a backseat, but something to also help.
You guys are all so smart.
I think we should go on to the next aliquot.
All right, caption.
All righty. So in aliquot 6, we decided to get some imaging following up the right upper quadrant ultrasound. So we had an MRI abdomen. And that shows no biliary ductal dilatation, some borderline splenomegaly, and no abdominal lymphadenopathy. And we send off a whole host of labs. We send off some hepatitis labs that are not detected, HIV is not detected, RPR is not reactive, EBV, CMV, IgM negative, HSV1, HSV2, ANA is all negative, CNCA, PNCA negative, anti-mitochondrial negative, anti-smooth muscle negative. So basically, a lot of really important pertinent negatives. Not necessarily a whole lot of positives, but does this start to impact and fill you in on what your differential could be and what diagnosis you're starting to lean towards?
Yeah, that is a lot of negatives. And I think the long list of negatives, especially for Hep A, B, C, really drives home it is not any of those like yellow fever or HHV4/5s. I think it's interesting that the HSV1, the IgG is negative. Part of me is thinking, would we be able to check the IgM? Because I know that those are two different markers. And that's where I'm at right now.
I was hoping one of these would be positive so we could, you know, win, slam dunk it, but it's not the case. I think something I've learned is how important each individual line in this is, because I think when you're doing like hepatitis labs, I remember the first time I learned how much you like run for that is things can be positive, but it not mean that there's an acute problem. It could just be a chronic thing that they've had their whole life, but is resurfaced in a way. But since we're not seeing this picture here, like the viral hepatitis is essentially off my differential. What's confusing to me, not confusing, but interesting, I guess, is that like there's some splenomegaly. So like possibly it's borderline. So possibly something like more immune function being impacted. Then I look at some of the markers at the bottom of this list, like the anti-mitochondrial, anti-smooth muscle, the ANCAs. These are immunological markers and they each point to different possible diagnoses. Since they're all negative, those diagnoses are possibly off the table. But if I had to pick between, if we're looking at a hepatitis picture, I would say no to viral, but I need to explore more for autoimmune. Even with these labs, I don't think we can rule out drug toxicity, and we can't rule out a shock liver.
I guess I'm going back and I'll ask the two of you. Maybe I'll start with you. This is not guess what I'm thinking, but I had to start putting a name on what you think the problem is. Not the exact diagnosis, the bucket that we've fallen into, because we talked about some of these big buckets when you started. and you've used the term before, what would you, if you had to say, here's this medical problem, I call it X, not specific, but broad, what would you call this medical problem?
Yeah, so at the beginning of this episode, I said my buckets were infectious disease, genetics, and maybe something autoimmune related. I think just going off of Andrew's points, how he's leaning towards autoimmune, maybe some inflammation there.
But I want you to step back a little bit. If you think about it in that way, what would you call this condition?
Well, I'll step in because I know Caroline's anatomy today was maybe cardiac stuff.
Yes.
If I remember correctly from M1. I mean, I'm thinking about the buckets. If this is what you're getting at, it could be like an intrahepatic situation.
So no.
What do we have evidence of?
What do we have evidence of? Maybe that is. Mm. You've used the term. You guys both use this term before.
Hepatitis?
Yeah, that's okay. That's right. So this appears to be a hepatitis, which means what? What does it mean? We use these words all the time. What does hepatitis mean?
Inflammation of the liver.
Now we're just arguing about what's causing the inflammation, but this seems to be an inflammation of the liver.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And then you can organize your differential around, well, okay, so what are, you did it so beautifully before. What are the causes of this? You've already sort of gone there. You've divided it up into these causes, and based upon the information we know, you're moving towards one of these, potentially moving towards one of these buckets.
I love this. Just dump truck unloads on the driveway of all these negatives. I'm like, yes. Because this is when I go to friends. I say, I have this, I know there's this focus problem that we can't come up with an answer. So none of the common things we see often. I know we're getting into the realm of unusual things. Honestly, this is also when I go to ChatGPT. I throw in my best problem representation of the case with pertinent negatives, like we've worked at viral hepatitis, autoimmune hepatitis, et cetera, and kind of feed the model as best you can and ask for a differential to help remind me of things I might not be considering. And I just use it as another tool. It's a virtual friend. But that being said, let's go to Alcott 7, where we get some tissues. In these cases is often the issue. We have a liver biopsy. Consistent with acute hepatitis. There's no viral inclusions. Iron stain is negative. So for Carolyn, that's saying basically no hemochromatosis. Copper stain is negative. That's saying likely no Wilson's disease. The PASD stain is used for alpha-1 antitrypsin. That's also not seen. So pertinent negatives, but a confirmatory pathology report of acute hepatitis.
Isn't it nice that actually were able to come up with the pathology of this before you got the pathology. I mean, the pathology confirmed what your thinking was, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Where are you going from here?
I am really impressed that we both actually, we did land on hepatitis, and I think seeing the acute in this aliquot makes me think more about that. Okay, maybe we should be checking IgM, maybe we should be checking other IgE, IgD, all sorts of stuff. And the no viral inclusions is also a good term for me as well.
I appreciate the negatives here of like the Wilson's and the hemochromatosis. And I need to be reminded of the no evidence of the alpha-1 antitrypsin. I think about emphysema, but if I remember from my step one studies correctly, the liver is involved with that. Is that true?
Well, totally true. You're at risk, especially earlier in life, of cirrhosis.
Okay. So I think we need to dive a little deeper on the acute hepatitis picture here, and that probably involves ordering more labs.
This is when you get your hepatology consult.
Yeah.
Come on out day one.
You've done the work. You've gotten tissue. You're stuck. You ask for help.
So you call your friendly neighborhood hepatology colleague, and they recommend some additional workup. Let's go and see what that is.
Yeah.
So they recommend that you check IgG subclass levels. The IgG1 is upper end of normal. The IgG2 is within normal limits. IgG3 is within normal limits. The IgG4 is very significantly elevated. The IgG4 and IgG immunostains on the liver biopsy showed an increase in IgG4 positive plasma cells more than 10 per high powered field, and an IgG4 to IgG ratio more than 40%. So we have these numbers. You already put a name to the problem, right? A couple aliquots ago, you mentioned, this is what this is. This is the problem that I'm putting in my progress note for the day. Now we have more numbers that are really starting to clue us in. Is there a name that you would put to this problem to call it this diagnosis?
I don't know if I have a name yet, but I think it's really interesting that the elevated IgG4, I would like to connect it back to what we saw in the ultrasound and how we saw a little bit of the hepatosplenomegaly, but it wasn't too much. And I can't help but think about, okay, so there's increased IgG4, probably a lot of mast cells, a lot of inflammation in the area, and that might be
hepatitis. And then we're combining this, what we found here immunologically, with the IgG4. So combine those together and maybe it's IgG4 autoimmune hepatitis.
We get the final diagnosis from the tissue biopsy stating your patient had IgG4 associated autoimmune hepatitis. And so even before we got to that final aliquot, even before we got to our hepatology consult, you guys worked all the way from the initial chief complaint with one line to acute hepatitis. And then you call your colleagues for help and put a name to it, start a treatment plan. But you guys took that basically beginning, middle, and end.
Well, we were guided by an excellent team.
Yes.
And I mean, I agree, like earlier, Dr. Abrams saying how fun this is. I think this is, in my experience of M3 so far, what the joy of medicine can look like when you have a team willing to guide different levels of medicine along this journey of what are you thinking next and giving their thoughts. I think what we have around the table here is really indicative of that whole process. An M1, an M3, an intern, PGY3, and
PGY39.
An expert.
Sorry.
So yeah, this is great. Teamwork.
This disease did not exist when I was a resident. Okay, this is, you know, and this is something that you guys will see over your career, and that is things we can't put a name to, we can put a name to someday. When I was a student and a resident, hepatitis C didn't exist. We called it non-A, non-B hepatitis because we didn't know that there was hepatitis C. Yeah. And this is a relatively new, we described disease, was described, you know, like maybe 30 years ago in a very specific population, how these diseases are often described, mm-hmm. and that it and the presentation that unique cause of pancreatitis at that time. Yeah. That was the initial presentation. And then over time, we've learned that this IgG4 disease can probably affect every organ system in the body. And so this disease, think of it this way. You saw the biopsy, it's an inflammatory disease. There's cells in there. And in many ways, this is a plasma cell disease, making a lot of IgG4. It's infiltrating the liver, causing hepatitis. I can tell you the outcome with this patient was started on prednisone. This patient got totally better.
Yeah.
Okay, so they were totally better. Of course, you know, again, it's 2024, and now we have biologics, so people don't have to be on prednisone forever. They were switched to one of these biologics, but absolutely 100% got better. And again, it's a specific type of autoimmune disease. Right, you were right in that bucket from the beginning.
Yep.
That, you know, that now we can put a name to, and you know, when we start being able to put names to them, we treat them better.
Yeah,
we also can think about them differently.
Yeah, and I've seen a couple of cases in this IgG4 related spectrum of diseases. I don't even know what specialty it falls under these days. I think rheumatology thinks about it a lot. Don't have a diagnostic criteria, but rather a classification criteria, because everyone is so different. Mm-hmm. It's usually multi-system. There's never fevers, if I remember. Another pearl is the IgG4 subclass being elevated is only 80%. So 20% of cases will not have that elevation, but still have the disease. There is no perfect test.
I had a patient I've taken care of for 30 years. He presented in the early 90s. He presented as having retroperitoneal fibrosis. I don't know if you guys have heard about that. It is what it's like.
Yeah.
It's a fibrosing of your retroperitoneum. Usually it's manifest because you got to think about things that run in your retroperitoneum, and so they often can get hydronephrosis and
yeah.
things like that. What we've learned is that probably the most common cause of retroperitoneal fibrosis, or one of the most common, lymphoma can do it, but IgG4 disease yeah. can do it. That was years later when he presented with a different manifestation of IgG4 disease that we were able to connect the dots. Literally, this was over 20 years.
Wow.
And when he presented with the second piece, we could say, this is it. And then we could put those, we could put that puzzle together. Wow. It was really amazing.
Wow.
That's cool how that played out.
Well,
what would you guys think?
I really enjoyed today. I feel like I learned so much, and this is something I'll never forget now because it's burned in my brain. It really has shown me, as Andrew said, this is a really beautiful part of medicine, and I'm really excited to be part of it.
I agree completely, and I'm happy Caroline got a chance to join. This is M1, and for me, it's M3. I start my internal medicine rotation in 1 week, so this is a great, great primer. And I'm very excited because it's like probably in my
Be with me. I start in 1 week too.
All right, I hope so. It's probably my top choice of specialty at this point. So this just kind of validates this interest of, you know, the investigative process in medicine, and you know, using what you've learned over the many years of training to make it happen.
Well, thanks for joining us. Good to see you guys again. It was fun to be behind the mic, and we'll get back together soon, yeah?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Wow, that was fun.
This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.